I'm a war child myself, so I grew up under siege and I grew up in a civil war, and naturally that just left me with a lot of questions.
That was Zinaida Bashirovich, and you are tuned in to the Peace Frequency. Hello and welcome to the Peace Frequency, a podcast series tapping into the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible and finding ways to create a world free of violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge, and today we are broadcasting from our studio at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. Joining me in studio today is my co-host for today's episode, Lily Cole. Lily is a senior program officer here at USIP, where she directs our fellows program. So Lily, thanks for co-hosting the show with me today.
Thanks for having me, Darren.
And of course, our guest is USIP scholar Zinaida Bashirovich. Zina is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Berkeley. Her dissertation is titled Equal Rights, Inherent Dignity, and the Small Print: How Children and Adults Make Moral Judgments About Violations of Human Rights. Zina's dissertation is a cross-cultural research study based on clinical interview method, comparing children and adults in their reasoning about violations of human rights and infringements on human dignity. She works with populations in the US, Turkey, and the Balkans, looking at several dimensions of cultural differences and similarities between the three, including how historical legacies and socio-political realities may differently impact people's perceptions of who and when does or not merit rights and dignity. Studying people at different ages, she also hopes to better understand in what ways does moral reasoning change with development, and whether and why we become more likely to tolerate harm. So Zina, thanks for sitting down with us today.
Thank you for hosting me.
So Lily, for our listeners who are not familiar with USIP's Peace Scholars Program, it would be great for you to give us a brief overview of what that is, but I first want to take us behind your bio, Zina, and we start all of our episodes with a question that can give us some insight into who you are, what inspires you, learn something about you that we wouldn't necessarily get from one of the bios that we find of you online. So you had a little time to prepare for this, and I thought about this question, and since your research has you working with children, I wanted to ask you a question about your childhood. And the question is, what was your favorite toy growing up as a kid? What was it about that toy in particular that brought you so much joy or comfort?
My dad used to travel a lot, and he traveled around the world. He was an engineer, and he really literally traveled the globe. And he would bring me these dolls. When I was a little kid, he would bring me toys and dolls from all over the world. So as a kid, other kids would come to my house to see all these artifacts from around the world that were just looked like something that we couldn't find in shops back in former Yugoslavia when I was a kid. But what I would do with these representations of
the UN of
little,
dolls,
right? The UN of dolls, exactly. What I would do with them, and this may sound a little bit disturbing, but you have to bear with me. I would eventually take their heads off and look inside, because I wanted to
In their
to
bodies
know,
or in their heads?
In their heads, because
okay.
I wanted to. I would take the heads off, and then I would start poking around inside, because I wanted to see, well, how does this blinking work? Well, there must be something inside the head, and what's inside the doll? And I would shake them. And now, to some psychologists coming from different traditions than mine, that might be like alarm bells. This kid is disturbed. But I now, interpreting it myself, I'm thinking, you know, this was a harbinger of a particular interest. I have always been interested in what motivates people, what makes them tick, you know, what is it that happens inside the head, behind the eyes? What influences perception?
Interesting. It all makes sense.
Right.
It all makes sense. How did your parents react to that when they saw you taking heads off of dolls and inspecting? What were their reactions to that?
Well, my mother would always tell my dad, do not bring her. You're not going to get any more toys. This is the end of toys for you. You need to, you can go outside and play in the dirt or something, but we're going to stop wasting all this money on you. My dad, being a dad, and now I have children on my own, and I see my husband how he is with my daughter. I see this connection where, you know, you're your daddy's princess. So all I would need to do is look up and blink, and yes. He would be like, yeah, what kind of a doll would you like?
I have two daughters, so
yeah. So
I know exactly what you're talking about. Right? Yes, exactly.
When did you decide that you wanted to study and then pursue a career in cognitive developmental psychology?
I think it seems, based on my treatment of my toys, subconsciously must have been when I was about 2 or 3. But I think the time when it became a decision and a direction that I moved in was, I kind of had a long way of coming to the psychology perspective on what I'm actually studying, which is human rights and justice and harm and violence. I had started with being interested in human rights and perpetration of violence and harm as a teenager, I guess, because I'm a war child myself. Mm-hmm. So I grew up under siege and I grew up in a civil war. And naturally, that just left me with a lot of questions that nobody was necessarily able to answer for
like
me
what?
In a satisfactory way. Why do societies disintegrate from one moment to the next? From my perspective of a teenager, it was something that happened from one moment to the next. Mm. One day, I'm sort of, you know, decapitating my dolls. But, you know, 1 minute I'm playing with all my friends outside, and we were also in former Yugoslavia. We were very much, I guess, later on with an adult's eye, you look at it differently and you say, well, we were steeped in ideology. But for a child, it's a natural sentiment. And I loved my country. I thought that we were all sharing in this idea of brotherhood and unity. I grew up with no notion of religion being something that creates divides between people. I was just curious about religious temples in Sarajevo, where I grew up. In a space of 100 yards, we've got all 4 religious temples facing one another. Mm-hmm. Orthodox Church, Catholic Church, the synagogue, and a mosque. And at a certain time of the day, they all produce their own music. The bells go off, and the call to prayer from the mosque. It's an interesting place to be sort of growing up and understanding the world around you. So you can imagine how shocking it then becomes when, in that kind of a context, you're suddenly plunged into, back into the dark ages, and you're literally shut in a box because Sarajevo was under siege for 3.5 years. And this was when I was in my preteens. And going through my development in that kind of a context, it was difficult for anybody around me to really, people around me, adults around me, couldn't really rationalize, let alone sort of translate it to a language understandable to me. So then when I left and I went to the UK as a refugee, these questions were still lingering, and I wanted them answered. I needed them answered because it was a matter of me kind of tracing back my identity. I felt that I had lost my identity. So I thought, unless I can answer this in some way, I can't find that thing that I've lost. So I got on a journey. And I thought that a natural way to start is to study political sciences, which I did for my bachelor's degree. Then I started working in the NGO sector and for the government. I worked for the British government in post-conflict development, which actually took me back to Bosnia. And I worked on some of their projects, and in particular worked with like youth empowerment and on a big social restructuring post-conflict development program. But I don't know if I was necessarily looking for closure, but that wasn't enough. I felt that I was only seeing one piece of the story, and what I was after was a much bigger mosaic. So I went back to school, and this time I thought, no, I need to understand the ethics. I need to understand the sort of the philosophy behind this. So what do? I'll take a master's in philosophy, which I did, and then in the master's I focused on the moral ethics of humanitarian interventions. How do we justify humanitarian interventions, and can we justify a use of force in prevention of genocide? And that was a cheerful topic that I spent a couple of years grappling with. And then right after that, I thought, okay, well, that's another piece, but really, what am I after? I'm after something tangible. I'm after something that I can turn into a skill that I can deliver, a tool that I can give. So I thought, I need to know what people are thinking, because if I want to know how to help them, I need to know what they want. Mm-hmm. And if you want to know what people are thinking, as my wise advisor always says, well, you got to ask them. Mm-hmm. And psychology teaches you the tools to do that in a systematic, scientific way. So that was my short 35-minute answer to your question.
No, that's very helpful.
That's the journey.
That's great. Well, thanks for sharing that with us. And this journey now, of course, has brought you, now we're in 2017, and you're a USIP Peace Scholar. That's what brings you to Washington, D.C., and why you're sitting down with us today. So, Lily, you run the Peace Scholars Program. Can you tell our listeners what is it and what kinds of scholars it seeks out, and how does the program support them?
Yeah, so Darren, the Peace Scholar Program, which Zena is now a part, is our predoctoral award program. It's very competitive, and it's been in existence almost as long as the Institute. We have supported the doctoral research and writing of hundreds of people who have gone on to become really outstanding scholars, really developing the field of peace and conflict resolution. This year, we have 14 people in the program, and we have quite a range of disciplines, although it's fair to say the majority who work in this field are still in the fields of political science and international relations. We also tend to have historians, anthropologists, but we've had some conspicuous absences in disciplines and sort of approaches to the questions of why human violence? How do we prevent it? How do we rebuild societies after it? And I think, at least in my time, Zena is the first psychologist to be part of the program. So it's high time. And I think she's really going to contribute to our goal, which is to continue to build the field of peace and conflict studies. So that's part of the Institute's mission to a vision of a world where conflicts are solved nonviolently. And we, of course, need not only the input from different disciplines, but from also different personal experiences and motivations, which is why we're looking forward to talking more to Zena today about her work.
All right. Well, let's jump into your specific research.
So, Zena, yeah, tell us where you're a graduate student and what your research topic is.
Okay, so I'm coming to you from University of California, Berkeley, and I'm at the Graduate School of Education at Berkeley, but in a strange way, we tend to be sitting on two chairs. I'm in Human Development and Cognition program, attached to my advisor, Professor Elliot Turiel, who's a psychologist, and it wouldn't be too much to say legendary moral development psychologist. So my training is that of a cognitive developmental psychologist, even though I sit in the GSC. And my work, I focus on children and adolescents in particular, although I look at the full sort of developmental trajectory, so I will start from children as young as 7 and then work towards adults. And I'm looking at, for my dissertation in particular, in a broader sense, I'm looking at different aspects of reasoning about harm and injustice and fairness and violence. But specifically for my dissertation, I'm looking at how people reason about violations of human rights and also how people conceptualize dignity, which for my own purposes identify as a sentiment, as an emotion. So part of my study as a psychologist is also to look at how the development, affective development, development of emotions, and how emotions interplay with moral judgment and with reasoning about social norms, reasoning about rules and authority dictates. So I try to kind of bring all these components to bear on the question of how we perceive human rights and what way they're meaningful to us and what kind of differences we see across cultures and what impacts our understanding of our own rights and others' rights. Does cultural context impact it? Does personal experience of some social encounters impact that? So in that sense, I'm interested in post-conflict societies or divided societies and differently in different ways divided or conflict-ridden, to see whether your personal experiences of how you live your life and what you're faced with on a daily basis, does that influence moral judgment in any way? Does it, if you're coming from a conflict-ridden country where violations of human rights are much more of a daily occurrence and much more of a systematic practice, is that going to make you more desensitized or inclined to make your judgment differently? And also, is that going to affect development? Mm.
So your research, as you describe it, has me thinking about the Seville Statement on Violence. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar with this.
Tell me.
So the Seville Statement, I think this was in early 80s. Mm-hmm. The UN in Seville brought together the world's top scientists in a variety of fields, psychology, anthropology, biology, psychiatry, to answer the question or explore the question, are humans inherently violent, or mm-hmm. what is the human propensity to mm-hmm. commit acts of mm-hmm. violence? And the reason I refer to it a lot is because their statement was that it is a myth mm-hmm. that humans are inherently violent. This is an excuse that a lot of people give when countries go to war and people kill each other. They throw their hands in the air and say, well, you know, that's humans. That's just what we do. We're violent. And mm-hmm. they give a lot of different reasons for that. Mm-hmm. Even though they're not scientists, they'll say, well, we're primates are violent and, you know, we come from primates and that's mm-hmm. why. Or mm-hmm. X, Y, and Z, they'll give some examples. So the UN was like, well, let's actually ask, you know, the top scientists who are actually looking at this to answer that question. They all came back saying, that no, those are myths, and that human beings are not inherently violent. Now, just like any good scientific inquiry, there are people who challenge it and push back and forth on those things. I know Steven Pinker was one person who said he had some issues with that statement. So I pose that question to you because, you know, we're curious about, are other people researching the same topic, or have other people researched it? And given this statement that was made in the early 80s, I'd love to hear your reaction to that. The question, are human beings inherently violent? This statement said, based off of a lot of different scientific schools of thought, no, it's not. But so far in your research, how would you respond to that question?
Okay, so I would, first of all, separate that into two questions, and I would identify a problem that I have with each. One is the idea of what is inherent. And the other is just the concept of violence being treated as something that is a monolith. Violence is something that happens on a spectrum. And for me, studying violence means understanding and appreciating and also parsing out how that the continuum on which it occurs, because it is something that is dependent on context. It is something that happens in a spectrum in terms of content, in terms of intensity, and also in terms of justifiability. So these are all aspects that have to contribute to our understanding of violence when we're talking about it, instead of just saying, well, there is this thing, violence. Is it inherent or is it not inherent? So we have to just, first of all, understand that this is a much larger concept to sort of delve into than just a monolithic thing. The other piece was the idea of what is inherent. In my approach or my strand of psychology, which is cognitive structuralist,
And what does that mean for the lay people?
Okay, it sort of means what it says. I guess it spells itself out. It suggests that the way that we reason is via reason or reasoning / cognition happens by way of forming structures. So the way that we understand reasoning developing from small children onwards is by children interact with the world. And in those experiences, through social experiences and through their interactions with the world, they develop understandings of the world around them. And that development literally translates into structures. That is the sort of the cognitive structural part. Okay. So we understand the structure, we build structures of understanding around social experiences that we have. In this process, children are not recipients, as perhaps some other strands of psychology would suggest. They're active participants. Because this is a reciprocal relationship, and this is something that we often also see in children. They're pushing back on boundaries. They have their own ideas that they're testing out. Their things are, and you know, when you have small children, right? You know,
yeah.
I'm not just gonna teach them something. They have their own agendas, but this is how they develop their knowledge of the social world. So, in that sense, the idea that violence is inherent is problematic. It's a problematic statement on both accounts, on the accounts of anything being inherent, sort of pre-existing and not due to any exposure to social experiences, and also problematic in a sense that violence is not something that we can just observe as a thing. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest that if we want to talk about something being inherently, perhaps we all have a tendency to develop in any direction. There's possibilities for us to develop in many directions. But what we socially experience and what currents interfere with that is going to shape it to a great extent.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So, Zina, what case studies did you choose, and why? Which ones are you focusing on in your writing?
So for my dissertation, I chose, because as I was saying before, I thought for me it was important to look at several dimensions. One was to look at development, so to look at kids and adults. One was to look across cultures, in that I can look at societies that are both similar to some extent, but also different. And I also was interested in this aspect of exposure to violence and the extent of exposure to human rights violations. So I chose, initially, I was resisting choosing the Balkans as one of the regions for some obvious reasons, that it's just too close to home, and that I also felt that I'm kind of oversaturated with it, that I really don't need to go there again. But then it was suggested to me that it would probably look more strange, given that I do come from the Balkans, and I can't really hide that, nor do I want to hide it, that it would look more strange if I didn't talk about it than if I did include it, because people would be wondering, well, why, surely you want to say something about... So I kind of conceded, and I thought, okay, well, I guess logistically will also be super easy, because I've got all the connections already. And I speak the language, so that's very helpful when you're doing field work. And it would also give me a reason to go back that, you know, somebody else can pay for. So several boxes tick there, but it is also a useful site because it is a society that is post-conflict in theory, but not really in reality. And there's a lot of issues that are bubbling under the surface and that are due to just issues of justice not really being properly addressed at the time that they were being addressed. And people have grown out of that, or have kind of continued, not even grown out of it, I guess, like continued to fester in this mood of resentment and disillusionment. So I thought that would be an interesting component to bring in, to see what happens when we talk to people many years after conflict resolution and reconciliation and all these processes, and things have actually not really worked out. How does that impact the development of next generations who are inheriting that messy society, and also inheriting the legacies, and also inheriting all of the baggage? Inheriting to an extent the sense of resentment as well towards the international community that sort of landed them in this situation.
We're going to take a break, but okay. When we come back, we'll ask Zina about her methodology in conducting research on this topic, a topic that can, as we've learned so far, can be very sensitive and deals not just with adults, but also with children. Welcome back. You're listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series tapping into the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible and finding ways to create a world free of violent conflict. I'm your host, Darren Cambridge. Joining me in studio today is my co-host for today's episode, Lily Cole, who has been running the Scholars and Fellows program here at the United States Institute of Peace. And our guest is USIP Peace Scholar Zinaida Bashirovich. Zina is a PhD candidate at the University of California, Berkeley. Her dissertation is titled Equal Rights, Inherent Dignity and the Small Print, How Children and Adults Make Moral Judgments About Violations of Human Rights. So we left off talking about where you're doing your research. Continue with that a little bit.
Yes. So another site that I'm also looking at is Turkey. And Turkey I've chosen for a different set of reasons. In a way, both Turkey and Bosnia are similar to the extent that they are both European countries. They're the only European countries that have majority Muslim population. And they are democratic, secular countries that are nevertheless very much culturally oriented towards the Islamic tradition, which I thought would possibly make them very different in how they receive the idea of human rights, which are often said to be very much a Western tradition rooted in enlightenment and certainly in the US and in the Western world, disseminated kind of through these liberal political ideals that are associated with enlightenment and Christianity. And so in that sense, I was interested in whether populations that are oriented towards a different religion would have a different take on both receiving the idea of human rights and also on conceptualizing dignity. Because as something that is a concept that anchors human rights, I'm also interested in how people reason about dignity. In addition, while Bosnia is a society that is in a way post-conflict and kind of still continuing to grapple with these issues of properly reconciling, Turkey has a different set of problems in that they are right now in the midst of a crisis. And in both countries, actually, voicing your human rights, let alone finding the mechanisms to realize them, is a bit of a challenge because the institutions of justice tend to be insufficient and corrupt. So all these things create a certain kind of a social situation and a certain kind of a social normative pool in which it might be a different proposition to swim if you're looking to realize your rights.
Interesting.
So can you give us a brief introduction to your research methodology, who you're interviewing and what kind of things you're asking them?
I've been asked a lot of times to try and give a brief introduction to my methodology, and it's a complex approach that also requires explaining a whole sort of subfield of psychology to people who are not necessarily from the field. But I work within a theory authored by my advisor, who himself was an advisee of Lawrence Kohlberg, who's known as the father of moral psychology. So it sort of comes from that tradition, but Toriel, my advisor, has kind of taken a step further and built something else out of it. And the basic premise here, the sort of gist of it, is that, first of all, that people always reason, that people are always engaged in thinking, that there's no such things as quick intuitions. We're always thinking. Sometimes we're thinking quicker, sometimes more deliberatively, but we're always thinking. And we reason within three different domains. The domain of moral, which is to do with evaluating things on the basis of justice and fairness and harm and welfare. The domain of social conventions, which is the domain to do with reasoning about social rules and laws and authorities. This is very much culturally oriented. And then the domain of personal, which seems to be one that adolescents are particularly engaged in, and this is the place where you would justify something on the basis of it being your prerogative, being things that are just your business. So that framework gives me an approach to conducting interviews in a way where I differentiate between two parts. I ask people first conceptually what their understanding of an issue is. So typically, do you know what human rights are? Can you tell me? Do you think that human rights can be in conflict with national laws? Do you think that people should sometimes be stripped of human rights? And explain why. And this is kind of gives me an idea of how they reason about this in abstract.
And you would ask this to a 13-year-old and a 40-year-old?
I would ask this to an 8-year-old.
Okay.
Even I've done a pilot study with a much younger group of kids, and it works. It works remarkably well. And then I would, the second part of the story is to put people in context based on this idea that sometimes we will reason differently when we are put in a situation where we're faced with something. Mm. So although you might sort of theoretically sign on to some idea, and or although you may know how to be politically correct, once you're placed in a real life situation, your reasoning will maybe change because it will depend on coordinating different kinds of things that are coming to you. Moral considerations, legal, social, rule-based considerations, and also your own preferences, your own emotions, your own what you think are your entitlements. So I will give people situations, dilemmas, real-life dilemmas, where I will present them with some real-life human rights violations, whether in their own country or somewhere far away, such as forced veiling of women in Saudi Arabia, such as torture of prisoners in the U.S., such as practices of the caste system and treatment of the untouchables in India.
So can you give us an example of how you would phrase that question? Like, let's take the caste system in India. Mm-hmm. How would you present that scenario as a question?
It is actually much more difficult than you might think because it takes a lot of meticulous work to put that scenario in a way that is absent of all leading kind of words or emotional words where that might sway somebody's opinion in some direction. So I would put the dilemma in a way that sounds very neutral as something that's very factual, and I would say something like, so you may be aware that in India there is a social structure called the caste system where people are divided into classes. There's a class that they call the untouchables, and this class of people usually engages in work for the richer. They get paid a minimum wage, but they are gainfully employed, and there are restrictions around classes touching each other, marrying across. So the untouchables can't marry, for instance, or touch anybody that isn't within their class. Do you think this is okay or not? Then they would tell me yes or no, and then I probe for why. And then I would ask them, well, do you think that it's okay for this to be a law? Do you think that this is okay if it is already a law? Then I would engage them in counter probes, and I offer counter rationale. Typically, most of people would say, no, that's not okay. Then I would come back and say, well, why isn't it okay? Some people say, look, you know, this is such a large country. There's 1.5 billion people. There's not enough work to go around for everybody. This way, they get to eat, they get to feed their families, they still have a community of their own. Why is it not okay? Everybody's happy. Mm-hmm. To see if I can sort of change their stance and if they would can be dissuaded from their moral position.
Interesting. I assume that not only when you are sitting down and writing these questions and wording them in such a way as you just described, but also now hearing you ask a question, do you ever have to sit and rehearse how you ask the question and your tone of voice and your body language?
Body language and composure so that I don't give them a signal that they shouldn't change their mind. That's the right answer. No is the answer. Stick with it. First of all, before we're even put in a situation, before we even reach the stage where we're doctoral candidates and we're doing our dissertation research and collecting data, there is a long road to cross before that point, where we go through a lot of training and a lot of pilot studies and a lot of work that by the time that we're actually doing this, I know how to do it.
Interesting. To follow up question on that, you said you have one child?
Two
children? Mm-hmm. Boy, girl, boys, girls?
3-year-old boy and a 5-year-old girl.
Okay. 3-year-old boy, 5-year-old girl. Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know, mm-hmm. having the skill set that you have, the awareness of cognitive developmental psychology, you're working with young kids. Do you ever step outside of yourself and think about how you observe your own children, given the work that you do? And if so, how does that, if at all, impact how you talk to your kids about mm-hmm. issues of violence or human rights or mm-hmm. what have you, or mm-hmm. when you observe them doing things that you can clearly see they're struggling about, whether or not this is something that they should be doing or should not be doing, and developing their own moral mm-hmm. framework?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It is certainly interesting to observe, and it's not something that once you're trained in something, I guess you can't, you're not able to switch it off. I guess in a way that when you're a pediatric doctor, you will see a rash and you know immediately what it is. Mm-hmm. So you know what medication to apply. I guess in a similar way, when you're working with kids or when you're working in developmental psychology, I think certain things pop up much quicker and more clearly. I try not to. Sometimes I catch myself treating my kids as subjects, and then I will often just go, stop it, stop it, stop it. This is, you can't be doing this. Because my daughter will start telling me something about, for instance, something that happened at kindergarten, and she'll say, and then this one came, and then he pushed her, and then I said, hey, don't push her. And we'd be walking home, and I said, okay, so what did you think about that? Did you think that was wrong? Why did you think it was wrong? What if the teacher told you that it was okay? Would that change your opinion? And then halfway through that conversation, I think, you're doing it again. She's not your subject. Stop it. But I think it helps, because certain things that are, I think, maybe confusing to parents who are not psychologists, to me, are maybe a little bit more easier to let go of, because I know that it is just something that will sort of iron itself out, and that this pushing back is a completely normal and regular part of development, rather than, I don't know, disobedience that you have to rein in or something. Mm-hmm. So it does, I think it does change my approach. And I guess also makes me maybe a little bit more inclined to just take it with humor or take a step back. Or sometimes when I see my kids fight and they're like punching each other, and I'll just kind of step back and I'll let them do it for a while to see what is the spirit that's coming out. Because I like the little one fighting for himself and standing his ground and all that, before I come in and break it.
Right, right. Well, thanks for giving us a kind of insight into your own family. Let's step back out into the work that you're doing in these various countries. Do you see your work as being useful for us to develop an understanding of human rights violations, in particular the mental processes of human rights violators, like what's happening in their brain when they commit these human rights abuses?
In general, I think it's important to understand how people are reasoning about the idea of their own rights or somebody else's rights. And in particular, I think connected to human rights, this notion of dignity to me is really a very crucial piece, because I think often what we see in a lot of the literature in political science and in philosophy touches on this. What we see in instances of violence and harm, and especially gross and systemic instances of violence, is that there is an aspect of dehumanization, and an aspect of treatment of a victim as someone absent of that human core, which is human dignity. And this lack of acknowledgement that this other person also has that same core, that same dignity that you're feeling or that is driving you to do whatever you're trying to achieve, is a pivotal point, I think. Something that is very important in conflict resolution or in a process of reconciliation, I think a central point that brings two people to the same table and engages them in a conversation has to begin with this acknowledgement that we both have dignity and that we recognize each other's dignity. That's a central notion within human rights. And in terms of investigating those who commit atrocities, at a time or at a time of a distance away from that? I think that's a very interesting question. And psychology hasn't really tapped into reasoning about human rights at all. So I'm kind of, you know, breaking ground here, and you're watching me stumble through it. So I guess this is a first step, but as a follow-up to that, I think it would be very interesting to look at the other side, because right now I'm looking at people who have witnessed and maybe experienced also harm and violations of their rights, and what they think about perpetrators and how perpetrators should be punished. But looking at the reasoning of perpetrators is a sort of the flip side of that coin, and that would be an interesting follow-up question. And I do have some ideas as to where that might lead, mm-hmm. based on the theory that I'm working from.
Mm. I think this is in line with what Darren just asked, actually, and because we are thinking in terms of policy here. What about your research and the idea of prevention of human rights violations? Do you think that your research is telling us yet anything about how to prevent human rights violations, or do you think it might at some point?
So I think that an important aspect of what I'm finding, and I guess maybe even the driving force behind it, is this aspect of applicability and the educational piece of it. And especially since I have this focus on adolescents and on kids and on their understanding and on also on how this understanding develops. And what I'm noticing already in some of my preliminary findings is that there is a difference between adolescents and adults in how they both conceptualize, especially the ideas of dignity and rights, and how they justify instances of violations, and if they do justify it, and how they conceive of punishment. So there is something does happen in the course of development that seems to, with age, make us actually more willing to negotiate around harm and to co-opt some ideas that are based in some cultural notions or norms, or it makes us more willing to say that harm is forgivable given X, Y, Z contextual circumstances or other sort of elements that are brought into the story. So something does happen in development, because children are much, much less willing to entertain these justifications of harm. And understanding that difference may give us some tools that particularly can be used in educational programs, in how we construct curriculum, in how we intervene in educational policies. What is the piece that's missing? Why are we allowing for this to happen? What is it? Where along this developmental trajectory this happens, and why? If we can identify that, we can maybe come up with some mechanisms of intercepting that.
So if I heard you correctly, you're saying that younger kids are less willing to negotiate around justifications for violence?
Adolescents in particular. So far, I've worked, my two age groups are young adults. So young adults are sort of college-aged,
okay,
18 to 25, versus adolescents 13 to 17. So adolescents are much less willing to justify harm. They're also much less willing to justify discrimination based on gender, and have very different ideas to adults of what dignity constitutes. If they are coordinating their justifications, if they're saying that something is both a moral issue and another type of an issue, they're more likely to say that it is moral and personal, whereas adults will say that it is moral but also legal and conventional. And that kind of leaning towards following legal and conventional norms can be a path down the rabbit hole, where you start justifying things like, well, we can torture people for national security, why not?
I was curious to know, how did you end up in Berkeley and at the University of California for your doctoral work? Had you done earlier parts of your education here in the United States, or what led you here from originally being from, I guess, Sarajevo?
Mm-hmm. So I spent my adolescence, I guess, and early adulthood, bachelor's degree in the UK, and I studied in London. And after that, I got to work with the British government. And yeah, after that, I worked for the British Guardian, the newspaper. The Guardian has its own division called the Guardian Professional that focuses only on research. Yeah. This is research that is for the purposes of government. So it's the government departments engage this department of the Guardian to do customized research for them that informs policy. So I guess this was also a point at which I started kind of tapping into research and sort of getting switched onto that and seeing that that's something that I enjoy doing. But this was in London, and I had a very much of a love and hate relationship with London, because it was a place that I came to as a refugee, but it was also, so in that sense, I had a resistance and a sort of a hatred for it. But it was also a place where I could just kind of disappear and become somebody new. Big cities allow you to do that, to reinvent yourself.
So that's interesting. So you feel you had a sense of hatred for that place. Mm-hmm. Is that because, I'm assuming, this wasn't a life choice of yours that had you end up there?
That's right.
And so when you did become a refugee, when the war broke out, that's just where you were sent. There was no, like...
Oh, no, I was in Sarajevo throughout the war. It was at the end of the war that I left.
Okay.
And I came to the UK through... a complicated set of circumstances, okay. But I got there, and at that time, the only option for me to stay, given where I was coming from, was to seek political asylum.
I see, okay.
At the age of 15.
Wow.
Which is really bizarre, as a little girl, age of 15, to seek political asylum. So, for a number of years, I was undocumented. I couldn't travel, I couldn't move anywhere. So, in that sense, I guess I hated London because it was a prison. Mm. So I went from one siege to another siege of a different kind. And of course, the UK is an island, so it's a different sense of entrapment. But thankfully, London is also a place that can give you something different every day if you're looking for something different every day. When you're a refugee and poor, maybe not so much, but yeah, I could walk, I could go, I could peek into places, I could dream. And I could see all the possibilities that are out there. So I had material to construct a vision of my future self and think about, how do I get there? Mm. So in a way, I got through my education there, and I got through a series of jobs. And then I met my current partner, who was from a completely different story to me. He was a musician. At that time, he had this punk band. He had no care in the world. It was just very amusing to me to see somebody living a life like that. That was completely alien to me. And intriguing, attractive. But his work and his music was in San Francisco. So he kept going between London and San Francisco. And at one point suggested to me to come for a visit, and I did, and I fell in love with San Francisco and the Bay Area. So I kind of, in a roundabout way, via sort of doing a master's degree in San Francisco, connecting with some people, I got to finally apply to Cal, and I got placed with my advisor, who I then remembered that as a teen in high school back in England, years before that, I was taking a psychology class, and one of our projects was to pick a psychologist, but don't go for the big names like Piaget or Kohlberg or something. Pick somebody more contemporary and evaluate their theory. So I find this guy, Turiel. I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, this sounds interesting. I've never heard of him, but I guess he's contemporary. He's alive. And I take read some of his stuff, and my project that I then presented to my high school class was just a complete decimation of the thing. This
and you're
guy
like 17 years old,
doesn't
16?
Know what he's talking about. I'm 16 years old, and I think that he doesn't know what he's talking about. None of this stuff makes any sense. And in some kind of a karmic or serendipitous sort of a way, I end up just circling back, somehow end up at Cal, and my advisor is none other than Turiel.
Wow.
And one of our first conversations, he says, I told him about that. And he says, because my high school teacher afterwards said, you know, you've got so many questions about and so many points on this theory, you should probably write to Turiel, and he's probably going to be seriously worried about what he's laid out. So when I talked to him and I told him, he said, and did you write to me? Like back then, 10, 15 years ago, I said, well, no, I didn't. Why didn't you? I would have cherished a letter like
wow,
that.
Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing.
Really spooky.
Yeah. Full circle there. So you have a master's in political science.
I have a bachelor's in political science.
Master's in philosophy.
In philosophy and in education.
And in education.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm assuming that all of those degrees influenced you, obviously, in some way. Now, earlier you were telling us about how none of those degrees until you got to cognitive psychology felt like they were allowing you to answer that question mm-hmm. that you've been grappling with since you were a child. But I'm interested to hear, is there like a thinker or a school of thought that you held on to from your bachelor's degree in political science that you're like, yeah, you know what, that's relevant, that's informative, that influences my way of thinking. Same for your master's in philosophy. Was mm-hmm. there something that you've held on to and said, that is something that kind of guides the way that I think or process this aspect of life, and with education as well?
Mm-hmm.
Who are some of the thinkers or schools of thought from those three degrees mm-hmm. before you even get to your PhD
yeah.
that you feel are still talking to you in some ways?
Mm-hmm. So a couple of people that I really admire and who do a very significant work in the human rights arena are Amartya Sen mm. and Martha Nussbaum.
Mm. Can you, for our listeners and for myself, explain Nussbaum and her work? And
so Martha Nussbaum and Sen worked together on developing a theory called Human Development and Capabilities Theory. And Martha Nussbaum, as a philosopher who has done, and a legal scholar and a theologian, and I think she's got like a slew of honorary doctorates, okay. has done this work in particular where she talks about the importance of human dignity and the importance of ensuring that people are living a life worth living. For all of us, what we're striving to is to be living lives that we estimate as lives worth living, whatever that means. And that truly what human rights, or in their interpretation, this approach, capabilities approach, is driving towards is creating this kind of a sense globally where those opportunities are available to everybody, where you can imagine that, and when you have the mechanisms to realize that,
mm-hmm.
a life that is worth living in your estimation. So, and she also does a lot of work in emotions and has an incredibly compelling theory of emotions and how we process grief in particular.
Interesting. So Amartya Sen, Martha Nussbaum, who else?
From philosophy, maybe, I always like to go back to the basics and, you know, looking at the current situation, and particularly looking at conflict and how conflicts develop and how societies transition and change and how they change into conflict. I kind of like to go back to the drawing board and think about Plato
mm-hmm.
and would recommend everybody to read Plato's Republic
mm-hmm.
and the way that he breaks down the process of disintegration of society, how it's generationally inherited, how a certain type of a parent has a certain type of a child, and how he kind of makes this parallel of a citizen and a state, and how generationally the citizen disintegrates into something morally reprehensible, and how that is paralleled in the system, in the state.
I have one more question. You talked a little bit about the training that you have to go through to conduct interviews and
mm-hmm.
ask these questions and learn what you learn from these folks. And, you know, I think working with any human subjects can be very challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd love for you to share with us moments where you've adapted and learned on how to do that work better. So I don't want
mm-hmm.
to phrase it as when have you made a mistake or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but particularly when working with adolescents, where you had one approach, something happened, and when you had to go back in and do that type of interview again, you did it differently.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is something that happens all the time. To some extent, I think no matter how much experience you've got, there is an element of that always, just because every time you're dealing with a new person in front of you, they bring with them all of their experiences and the full spectrum of their personality. So it's really not something that you can anticipate, and you should not also ethically, should not professionally, should not engage in anticipating. So while you can have a formula for a protocol for going about things, unexpected situations pop up. I always like to just continuously learn on the job, because sometimes, and I have had this happen a lot of times, where I would go back to transcribe my interviews and then code them, and I have a system of coding that I use, and then I would go back to my coding and then I would realize that I cannot code something because I didn't really pose the question properly, that I have not allowed somebody to elaborate, that the way that I ended up prompting something or pushing for something actually ended up influencing the person to answer in a different way. So sometimes that really amounts to just having to discard that completely. Mm-hmm. Because it's no longer neutral, it's no longer objective, it's no you too much of you is in it. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it just means adjusting your coding system or developing a new set of codes, because people will bring up things that you didn't even think could be a place to go in answering a question. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll say whatever I'm looking at, I will have a set of codes that I would apply, things that I would, ways that I would explain that reasoning. But then every now and then somebody comes along and says, well, here's how I'm thinking about it. And then you're just blown away because you have not even considered that.
And then kind of my last part of that is, like, where do you interview these young people? I mean, is it in their home? Is it in their school? And have they met you before? Because, again, I think the questions you're asking can really tap into difficult situations that could trigger people. And so how do you make these young people feel comfortable with you? And what does the space look like? What are all those considerations that you have to bear in mind when you're engaging in difficult conversations?
Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, the Institutional Review Board requires us to conduct all interviews in places that are confidential and that would not compromise the identity of the interviewer. So it has to be somewhere where I can be alone with the person. And it's also practically, this is a good choice because outside noise has impacts, not just the process, but the attention span. And I leave it to the participant to choose what they're comfortable with. When it's adolescents and kids, because that involves parental consent, I also have to involve the parents. So the parents have to weigh in on what they're comfortable with. It depends also on the site where I'm recruiting. If I'm going to schools, then it can be in a classroom or in a school office or at a community center, or it can be somewhere where the participant feels that this is a comfortable space for them. And then I will typically start the interview with a little bit of an icebreaker. If I'm talking to kids or adolescents, I will start with talking about something totally different. With youth especially, I would pick up on whatever is current, so I have to be current.
You gotta know,
on
right?
What's like, hey, you know, did you hear the new track from, you know, Kendrick Lamar? What do you think of it? You know, maybe try and use a little bit more jargon. What have you been up to today? And once I've sensed that they've relaxed a little bit, then I frame the interview as something that's just going to be a conversation. And if at any point they don't feel comfortable or they don't want to answer, that's totally fine. And that nobody's going to know about it, just me and them, and that I'm here to learn from them. And that it is very, and adolescents react in very interesting ways to being told that they are going to contribute to something really important and that their voices are going to be heard. This resonates with me. I always expect this to be so because I remember myself as an adolescent who was voiceless and who was in a situation where I had so much to say because I had been through so much, nobody was asking. And I remember thinking, I would have appreciated if somebody said, hey, what do you think? I'd had plenty to say. So this is kind of a way that I approach adolescence as well. And with adults, I have on several occasions had situations where people would just break down. They would cry. They would be reminded of something that is personal, that matters to them. And then this is sort of a little bit of a situation where a bit of clinical training comes in and how you talk to people who have experienced trauma and how you sort of... And then always after the interviews, there's a debrief procedure where we're kind of diffuse a little bit and go back because they've done so much talking and I say, well, let me do a little bit of talking and then I, because afterwards I can tell them what this is all about, so then I tell them what their opinion is feeding into and what it potentially is going to lead to, and that's usually a very satisfying feeling. Sometimes there are also incentives. I'll give gift cards. I say, thank you so much.
That's great. Thank you for that. Zinaida Bisharovich, thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you for hosting me.
Your story is fascinating. Your work is incredibly important. And I've got to say, I'm glad that your dad brought back all these dolls from around the world.
That was the beginning.
And yes, and helped encourage your interest in the human mind. And Lily, thank you for co-hosting the show today.
Oh, thanks, Darren.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Peace Frequency, a podcast series tapping into the stories of people across the globe who are making peace possible and finding ways to create a world free of violent conflict. The Peace Frequency is produced by the Global Campus, USIP's online learning platform designed to teach and learn critical peace-building skills. You can learn more about the Global Campus at usipglobalcampus.org. Our theme music for today's episode is composed by B.O. Crew. You can check out their free music at ccmixter.org. Our graphic designer is Manuel Leon, and I've been your host, Darren Cambridge. Be sure to check the Peace Frequency website to access a recording of this show and other archived episodes of the podcast. The URL is usipglobalcampus.org/peace-frequency. You can also subscribe to the Peace Frequency on iTunes and Stitcher. Until next time, keep learning, supporting, and building peace.